You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to the Cigar Nerd Podcast. I'm your host, Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
So, what are we smoking this week?
So, we've got the Tatuaje 2016 TAA exclusive. And for folks that don't know what the TAA is, it is the Tobacconist Association of America.
Yeah, the TAA is a group of approximately 80 retailers that basically get together once a year and have a meeting, talk about cigars and whatnot. And they always kind of purchase exclusive cigars for those TAA stores. So yeah, we are trying the 2016 Tatuaje TAA exclusive, which is a 6.25 by 50 Connecticut broadleaf with the Nicaraguan binder and filler.
Yep, and this is a box press cigar. I gotta say, man, I've smoked quite a few of the Tatuajes. You know, some folks will know them, from the Monster series that they do around their Halloween releases and stuff like that. So there's the Tatuaje, the Skinny Monsters, the Pudgy Monsters.
That's what they call me.
But, I've always been a big fan, just because they've always been consistent. I've never had a bad cigar, and this one holds true,
Their standard releases are good, and all their special releases they do have all been quality cigars.
Absolutely. So, with this right here, I'm going to say this is, to me, this is leaning more on the full side. Definitely getting some of the spicy notes, a magnificent construction on this. I don't know if it's the box press or just the time, but visually this cigar looks awesome.
And it has a little bit of a closed foot, so when you first light it up, you get a taste of that, that wrapper by itself before the rest of the cigar kind of comes in. And it's weird because I've been smoking so many 60 plus ring gauges lately that it's been a long time since I've smoked a cigar this small.
No, this isn't too far off from the traditional Churchill. But, with that box press, I don't know about you, but if I smoke a box press cigar, I more the 50, maybe a 54 ring gauge. You start getting into a 60 or something, and it has an awkward mouthfeel to it.
That with the bigger cigars, it's unless you're carrying a punch, it's hard to get those 60 ring gauge box presses in a regular cutter.
Oh, yeah, because the square shape, round hole, folks that are
square peg in a round hole never works. I think we all learned that when we were kids playing with those little plastic blocks toys that had the different cutout shapes and whatnot.
Oh, I made it work, but I had to melt away some plastic. But no, I back to the cigar here. Some woody, almost like a almost of an oak or something there that I'm picking up on. I don't know. I've only just got into the first third of the cigar, so really haven't got an opportunity to balance out all the flavors. All I can say is, so far, this is turning out to be a damn good smoke.
Yeah. And like I said, it being a TAA exclusive, you're going to have to find a TAA retailer in your area. I'm sure if you kind of Google that, you can be able to find it. If you're in our area, these came from the cigar shop in Cumming. Stop by to get one. Tell Tim we sent you. He'll be like, what, those two assholes?
Probably.
But he'll point you in the direction of a good cigar.
Absolutely. So, I don't know. This was his recommendation for this episode, and I gotta say, man, I'm really digging on it right now.
Yeah. And so, this episode, if anyone remembers a little movie called The Highlander, which came out 30 years ago.
Wait, there was only one?
There's only one worth watching, really. We'll get into that.
But there was a television series and 5 movies and an animated movie, and then there was a video game. And
I'm pretty sure there's a comic book at some point too. I don't know. There's a lot of them, but yeah, the original Highlander came out 30 years ago this year, so We're going to talk about, you know, they say there can be only one, but there was like five or six, but we'll get into that here in a minute.
Damn it.
And with that,
it was all a lie.
We'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
From the dawn of time we came, moving silently down through the centuries, living many secret lives, struggling to reach the time of the gathering, when the few who remain will battle to the last. No one has ever known we were among you. Until now.
Here we are, born to be kings. We're the princes of the universe. Here we belong. Fight to survive in a war with the darkest powers.
And welcome back to the podcast. It's time to sharpen up your swords and put on your kilt and talk about the Highlander.
Absolutely. Yeah. I got to say, man, like going back and watching these films, there was so much I was, you know, I caught a lot of the TV series and a few of the movies back in my younger years. But up until recently, I had not sat down and watched all of them in sequential order. And I got to say, I am now more confused than I've ever been.
Yeah, there's not a lot of continuity between, like, the six films, five films, whatever it is. Yeah, it's like, I'm pretty sure that original Highlander movie was meant to be a one and done. Yes. Like they said, there can be only one, but they're like, oh, this, because it didn't make a whole lot of money. I mean, they lost money on it, but it was it got such a huge cult following that they're like, we need to do another one. And they just kept getting weirder.
Yeah, it was just, you know, basically the budget for this film was $19 million, and the box office made $12.9 million.
Yeah, but I don't know what this has made on home video, because like the original Highlander film now is considered like a pretty great movie. I mean, it wasn't that popular back then.
Yeah, I mean,
1986.
And that was the thing is, you know, watching the movie, like you said, starting with the first one, you know, was not a bad film. But, you know, I guess the lack of continuity, the, you know, just weird plot twist that happened later in the series, just it seemed to kind of take away from that first film's greatness. Like, I can understand how the first one became, you know, more of a cult classic, if you will. You know, I mean, dude, the soundtrack to this film is the things that really stood out.
The soundtrack of the movie, and I think even part of the score, was done by the rock band Queen.
Yes.
Which I did not know this until recently. If you look, all right, let's talk about like the theme song for a minute. That original Queen's Princes of the Universe, like, I loved that song as a kid, but I only heard like that first like minute of it. From either the intro to the movie or it was also the theme song of the TV show, which we'll talk about later. But that was back in the day when you couldn't, like, just download stuff if you liked a song. Like, we literally, like, had to pull out our tape recorder and record it, like, off of the intro of the TV show just to have. And we did that one day just so we could rock out to that song. But there was an actual music video release for that song. If you go on YouTube and look up, you know, Princess Universe official video, apparently it was released with the movie, and it's freaking hilarious because it's them on the rooftop of the final battle that's in the movie, and it's intercut with like clips from the movie and them playing like on stage. At one point, Connor McLeod, since we haven't talked about him yet, even shows up and sword fights Freddie Mercury in the video.
That is awesome. I mean, what?
And the guitar player has a solo on the top of McLeod Castle. It's oh, it is.
I mean,
so
how much
weird.
More fitting can it be, though? You know?
Yeah. I mean, it was the 80s. Shit happened.
All right. So, you know, for folks that haven't seen the film, I guess, you know, we're going to get pretty in-depth. I'm sure we're going to have some spoilers. If you haven't seen the Highlander series, I would recommend going out and, you know, finding copies. You know, this is a great film to, you know, watch with friends, whoever, yeah. you know, that are, yeah, I mean.
And even the TV series, like, because this kind of got me just wanting to go back and watch, because that's probably where I first found the Highlander, was the TV show that came out in 92. But yeah, it made me want to go back and watch that, and you can pretty much find nearly every episode on YouTube if you don't want to, like, you know, actually go out and buy the Blu-ray or DVDs or whatever that. But which is only $120 for all six seasons on Amazon, I found. You go to the ESO Amazon, awesome. Amazon store and yeah. Go check that out. Plug for the network. But yeah, the
I see what you did there.
Yeah, like I said, if you want to watch a TV show and you don't want to go spend the money for it, you can find almost every episode on YouTube.
However, we don't condone piracy. So folks, use your better judgment.
I mean, they're so old now that it's like I said, you can find it on
it doesn't matter.
Oh, yeah, the original 1986 British American action fantasy film was directed by Russell Mulcahy.
Yeah, maybe that's how you pronounce it. Your pronunciation oftentimes is better than mine, so we'll go with it.
And starring Christopher Lambert and Sean Connery.
Yes. Clancy Brown and then Roxanne Hart.
And Clancy Brown is he who plays the... All right, first of all, if you haven't seen The Highlander, it's basically these guys are immortal. And they never explain it in the first movie, which I think that was, like, a good thing. They just are. And they have to... The only way to kill them is to... Are
better left alone.
To cut off their head and absorb their knowledge and power. And at some point that they will all battle till there's one. And he gets the prize, whatever... That happens to be because the prize, like, they change the definition of it from movie to movie, which we'll get to that in a second. But in the first one, it's like...
Man, talk about dangling, you know, the carrot in front of the horse.
Like, yeah.
Oh, you want the prize? Well, do this. Oh, well, you've done that? Oh, you want the prize? You must now do this.
Like I said, this movie was pretty much intended to be a one and done, I think, because... At the end of the movie, he is the one. He has won the prize, which for him is it's to grow old and not have to keep living. Because I thought I'd probably get, like, you know, I wouldn't be mind being immortal for, you know, maybe a couple hundred years. But eventually, it's got to get old where everybody you love, like, ages and dies before your eyes.
You know, at some point, stuff is going to go south. And it's like, this isn't worth living through anymore. Like, but it's also kind of weird that if you're immortal, that, you know, you die by getting your head, you know, beheaded ultimately. Like... Yeah.
The French Revolution must have sucked for the immortals, because there was a lot of beheadings back then.
Redefine. Something called the guillotine comes to mind, and yeah. I'm not talking about the cigar cutter.
Yeah, cause, and, you know, if you are the one, in the original definition, you got pretty much all the knowledge where you could basically link to everyone's mind and know everything, but now you're no longer immortal and eventually you'll die, so you got to do something with that knowledge while you have it, I guess. It's... I mean, they finally make what life worth living when you know there's like a...
Miyagi was an immortal.
Yeah.
That's how he had the wealth of knowledge. Danielson.
Yeah, Christopher Lambert is Connor MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod, born in the Highlands of Scotland. Where, you know, he eventually gets killed and becomes immortal, and his whole clan thinks he's the devil, so they... Banished.
Basically, you know, oust them, and you have been banished.
Until he meets Sean Connery, which Ramirez, but he had like a freaking like five title name. Yeah. Juan Sanchez Villalobo Ramirez, which is also kind of weird because they have a French guy playing a Scotsman, dealing with a Scotsman playing a Egyptian Spaniard.
I mean, it just keeps the dynamics fresh, you know.
I gotta say, you know, Connery's accent was better than Lambert's.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, it was definitely. I don't know. There were a few times where the accent was like, I think you kind of missed the mark there, buddy. But you know, continue rolling.
I mean, you've been alive 400 years. You've traveled a lot.
Your dialect, so your tongue.
Yeah, it kind of all starts blending together at some point. Yeah, Lambert's always had a weird a weird accent.
So much that you can now put on a New York accent and end up in some kind of sword fight in the middle of a parking lot where you just happen to lose your ancient relic.
Well, the thing is, the movie starts with him getting in a sword fight in, like, the basement of Madison Square Garden or something after a... was it a boxing match? Yeah, no, it was a wrestling match.
No, it was wrestling. Yeah, because I was looking and I was like waiting on like a Jake the Snake or somebody to be like in the wrestling ring or something like.
But it was like a legit wrestling group from the '80s too. I can't remember who it was. I gotta find it.
Yeah, one of those trivial facts that you know. Let's see. Da 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 da. Bum 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 bum
bum bum bum. But yeah, basically, like I said, he runs into another immortal, and they have a sword fight down in the garage. But yeah, apparently, you know, when the quickening is released, it's very very violent. So it blows up half the cars in the there. So as he's trying to flee in his classic Porsche, I believe it is, the cops around the place. So he had to like ditch his sword.
Yeah.
And a young forensic scientist happens to find a piece of metal at the crime scene, and she is obsessed with swords, so she's like, oh my god, this sword is older than samurais were supposed to be. So this, like, here sword, like, proves that, like, yeah, they were samurais around way before people were making swords like this in Japan, and now she's obsessed with finding the samurai.
Yes. Which yeah, is and really samurai, Brenda Watt is, you know, the character's name there. So, yeah, I mean, that was one of the cool things, you know, I guess about this film is, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of hand-to-hand combat. I mean, as immortals and having all that wealth of knowledge and everything, like, the swordsmanship and all of that stayed true. Like, you know, there was no, like, oh, I've got some kind of advanced fighting technique or anything to that effect. It was like, no, we must duel.
Yeah, that's one thing. Like, in the movies, they always focused on that, like, sword fight. They never really showed him doing a whole bunch of, like, you know, martial arts or kung fu, which when you get into the TV series later on, it was a lot more martial arts oriented. But then again, it was the 90s, and freaking everything was martial arts oriented. But you think you're 400 or 500 years old, you've got to, like, have picked up something along the way.
Yeah, I don't know. I was like waiting on some Mortal Kombat stuff, like, you know, lightning, you know, flashing, you know, or anything like.
Lord Raiden shows up.
Yes.
That's what happened. That's what the prize is. When you become the one, you get to be the lightning god of Earth. Because if anyone saw the old Mortal Kombat movie, Christopher Lambert was Lord Raiden.
So I don't know, man. Like the first one was not a bad film though. The first film I did enjoy. I liked a lot of. I don't know, you know, I mean, it was, you know, kind of a mix, you know, it almost kind of felt a little bit like a detective drama in a sense, you know, because there was so much, you know, focus on, you know, trying to track down the owner of the sword and, you know, going through all the history. And a lot of that stuff was cool because you got a lot of flashbacks from all kinds of different time periods as well. So
yeah, it's kind of like a weird period flick because it would flash back to him in, you know, Scotland when he first became immortal. And his wife, Heather. And then also, you know, he has a... Basically, in a... because what better cover for a immortal as to be an antiques dealer? Because, I mean, you can pick up a lot of crap when you've been around for 400 years. So, yeah, he is currently posing as an antiques dealer called Russell Nash. And he has a girl that's basically like his office manager or whatever, but... Turns out, like, he met her in World War II. She was, like, a young Jewish girl whose family had been killed by Nazis, and he ended up raising her as his daughter, but now he's still the same age, and now she's, like, probably a 50-year-old woman.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it was some of the flashbacks that kind of left me a little bit, you know, confused. I don't know, you know? I mean, there seemed to be so much going on that it was a little bit hard to follow, and I think maybe some of the plot holes, you know, it was like, all right, well, we're going to flash back, and then we're going to flash forward, and, oh, well, hold on, you know, this is more advanced technology, so now we need to fast forward the timeline a little bit to make it make sense on how you can have that, and
I forget what
it was a little tough to follow.
I forgot what he has some kind of smart ass quip too when he like guns down the Nazi. I forget what, because like yeah, he gets shot protecting the girl, and then she's like, "How are you still alive?" And he's like, "It's a kind of magic," which is something that he says throughout like the whole series. Like yeah, it's kind of a little running joke, but yeah, then he gets up and like yeah, takes the Nazi's gun away and blasts him.
Yes.
But I tell you, this movie, even though, like I said, it wasn't hugely popular at the time, has had such a huge cult following that it's really affected pop culture, because anytime you say the words, "there can be only one," you know, people know what the hell you're talking about. And it's like anytime you pick up a, at least from when I was a kid, anytime you picked up a sword, you were either Luke Skywalker or Connor or Duncan MacLeod. Anytime a sword fight broke out, it was like someone was going to say, "There can be only one," before
yes.
we started fighting.
I think this film inspired one of my friends, and I mean, he actually, you know, at the time kept a freaking sword in his car at all times.
Like, I mean, I never kept one in my car but when I was a kid, I collected knives. So I had like a bunch of swords. Like before I got old enough to buy guns, and then my knife collecting kind of, you know, slowed down. But yeah, back in the day, it was all about like swords and sword fighting and whatnot. And also, this movie, and then especially the freaking series, like, brought the trench coat back. It made it cool to wear trench coats again. Connor has the more traditional trench coat, and Duncan had, like, a series of badass trench coats.
Yes.
Because it's not like concealing we all concealed carries. You know, all he needs is a long t-shirt, but you know, if you're going to concealed carry a sword, you got to wear a trench coat.
A tactical trench coat.
Yep.
I don't know. I think this film also, too, kind of put the kilt on the map. Like, you know, kilt became hugely popular, you know, after a lot of my friends and stuff like that were talking about the Highlander movies. Like, before that, it was like, oh, man skirt, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it, you know, wasn't, you know, like what we have, you know, now, like when you go to conventions and stuff like that and you got, you know, 100, 150
utility
people.
Kilt, your tactical kilt, your traditional kilt.
Yep.
So. Your kilted kilt.
Not to be confused with the tilted kilt. That's for the after dark conventions.
The Scottish Hooters. Oh, but yeah, that and a lot of the flashback scenes of him in Scotland was actually filmed in Scotland. So I mean, you can't get a better like backdrop.
No, and I than, you like, know the, I think the fields some of Scotland. The visuals, you know, to this movie is really what captivated a lot of people. I know that was one, you know, another item that really stood out was, you know, just seeing some of the pan shots and, you know, the landscape. It isn't like, you know, what a lot of studios are today, and you'll be in the, you know, a middle of a big city and find a clearing and be like, all right, this is going to be a village in Africa. And
yeah,
you know, it's
like all things Marvel now. Yes. It's like South Atlanta is like, you know, home to a lot of different cultures and places. But back then they like, we want to film Scotland. We're going to freaking Scotland.
I feel like that's the way it should be.
It was probably just an excuse for Sean Connery to go pick up some scotch.
I'll take it.
Yeah. Oh, but yeah, he was like the Obi-Wan Kenobi of this movie. Yeah, you know, he found the Highlander when he didn't know what the hell he was doing, and taught him the rules of being immortal, and taught him to be a swordsman. And this their banter back and forth and like giving each other shit. I think what do you call him, like some like a. Kept calling him like a peacock, or he had some weird insult for him.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what that was. I don't remember if I don't remember what that was.
Oh yeah, but and then every good movie has to have a good villain, and Clancy Brown as the Kurgan, which was. Oh, he was actually the guy who killed Connor originally when he, you know, his first death. And he was just like this badass, like warrior guy with like almost like a weird skull helmet, and was hunting the Highlander. And even he ends up killing Ramirez and raping MacLeod's wife, and just an all around bad dude. But fast forward to the 80s. And it's come down to where it's just he's one of the final four or five immortals, and he's got this like badass like broadsword that like snaps together and stuff. Because I mean, you might be able to get away with a samurai coat and a trench coat, but a big ass broadsword, you gotta have another way to conceal that. And he's just like such 80s like weird biker punk guy with like a leather jacket and like a weird shaved head. It was just completely crazy. Like living that long has driven that dude like batshit insane. Yes. And I love the scene where one of the rules of being immortal, you can't fight on holy ground. That's where they can kind of come and talk things out without cutting each other's heads off. And of course, you know, he's in the church because he promised to always light a candle on his wife's birthday. And the Kurgan shows up and gives him a bunch of shit. And like, so it's this dude in like leather jacket, like shaved head, and like everyone's freaking out. And he gets up and he's like, "I've got something to say. It's better to burn out than fade away." And it was, what the fuck?
Yeah,
this dude's cracked out as he's harassing nuns.
Yes. Yeah, the helmet was one thing that always like stood out. I mean, I can remember, you know, like fucking, you know, sitting there as kids and stuff like that, trying to, you know, recreate that helmet or some version of that helmet or whatever. And
yeah, in the badass final battle,
sword battles with sticks out in the yard
on the roof of the, well, I think it was the Silver Cup building.
Yes.
I mean, and Clancy Brown's gone on to be, he's one of those guys, he's never a star of a movie, but he's always one of like the important supporting characters. And I've even heard a rumor, because it's been rumored for years that they're going to reboot the series and bring back the Highlander. And recently, it's been announced that if they do that, like, he's campaigning hard. He wants to be the Ramirez role. Which now, like, if you see him now, he's kind of an older gentleman. He's got a white beard and white hair. I mean, I think it would be kind of cool having him play the Ramirez role.
Yeah, no, I think it would be fitting. You know, like you said, you know, he's definitely aged into the role, so I could definitely see that being a thing.
And he's been more and more of a good guy in movies. So, you know, because like back in his younger days, he was always a villain. But, you know, he's always been like, you know, if not the main hero, at least a good guy in films. Or the father figure that gets killed and causes the hero to go on a vengeance spree. You know, so he's always that cool supporting character.
Yeah, and I don't know, you know, one of the, you know, kind of the interesting things, not just with the first film, but, you know, also the later films, are all the different versions and alternate endings and everything else that, you know, occurred. Like, you know, the European version of, you know, the film ends much differently than the American version. You know,
I don't think I've ever seen that version.
Yeah, there's a director's cut version, you know, and it runs like 8 minutes longer than, you know, the U.S. version that we've watched. So, I don't know.
What's the difference?
I mean, there's several different scenes. You know, there's one, McLeod having a short flashback about his first battle in Scotland that occurs during the wrestling match. There's a longer fight scene between Connor and...
I think that is the version that that we watch. Because, yeah, there's also a scene where him and the girl go to the zoo, and you can see the Kerrigan kind of stalking them in the background. I remember seeing that in the version I watched recently.
So, yeah, I mean, that was always the crazy thing, is there were so many, you know, special editions, director's cuts, alternate version, like, you know, in addition to just the sheer amount of Highlander stuff that is available and out there. And
speaking of alternate versions, let's talk about 1991's Highlander 2, The Quickening.
I gotta say,
when,
man, this...
shit got weird.
Yeah, like, it was so weird, in fact, that, you know, I don't know. Like, this film to me felt like it should not have been done.
It was so different. And like I said,
like, I mean, you know, like I think maybe because it tried to go so sci-fi or something like that. I mean,
yeah.
You know, depending on the version, you had, you know, versions that dealt with aliens. You had, you know, the director's cut version, which, you know, was completely different, that, you know, tried to somewhat tie in the first film, but then again, there was so many plot holes and just lack of continuity that it just left you like mind fucked.
Yeah, this one went from to like being trying to be a sci-fi film. I mean, it jumps way into the future where now McLeod is an old man, but at some point the ozone layer gave out and people were getting killed by solar radiation, so all of a sudden he's a scientist now, I guess, since he got the prize and learned everybody's knowledge. He invented a solar shield that would basically protect the Earth, but it basically locked us in internal darkness. And the world kind of turned to shit for some reason, just because there's no sunlight. It never really explains why the Earth went to shit.
Well, I mean, I think that kind of explains it. No sunlight, no plant life. I mean, theoretically, everything should have died.
But in the original version of this film, they tried to give an origin story of the immortals, and they were aliens. From, I can't remember the name of the planet they were from, but basically the immortals were rebels opposing the dictatorship or whatever it was, and they were defeated and captured, and as punishment, they were all transported to Earth in various time zones, and the prize was if whoever was the last remaining could return to their planet and be, like, forgiven, or he could stay on Earth and die of old age. So, the original general, Katana, sees the Highlander is the last one, and he's not chosen to come back yet, but he's afraid he will, so he sends some of his soldiers to kill him, and eventually comes to Earth himself to try to kill him, and brings him back to his, immortality. So now that, there's immortals on the planet once again, he's no longer aging, and he goes from being an old man back to regular Connor. And like I said, it's just a bizarre story. I mean, at one point, Ramirez returns because Connor kind of pulls him, summons him from the quickening, and when he needs help. And so now you have a modern Sean Connery, a 500-year-old Sean Connery,
yes,
popping into the future, which he lands in a middle of a Shakespeare play in like some outdoor theater in Scotland, and at first doesn't realize where he's at. So, and it's Macbeth, and he's doing the whole speech where he's talking to the skull, he's like one part, he's like that part where he's like, I've kissed these lips, and Connery's like, I don't know what you and your friend have been up to, but he's clearly dead.
And it's funny too, because you see the actor, and the actor's trying to be like, get the hell off the stage or blah blah blah, and the crowd
are laughing their ass off. I think it's like some weird
kind of parody or something. Yeah,
because he's wearing the same outfit he wore in the first movie when he died, so he's like dressed like an old Spaniard, and he's in the middle of a Macbeth play in like 2025 or whenever this movie takes place. But yeah, this version of the movie was so weird that they released a director's cut and then a special edition, which they basically updated some of the CGI effects. In the original, the sky was all orange, and in the special editions, they made it to like a weird blue. But yeah, they erased it. The first version that came out was called the Renegade Cut, and basically they erased everything that mentioned aliens. So now, instead of being aliens sent to Earth, they were from some kind of ancient civilization that had, like, technology, because there was guns and stuff for some reason. And as punishment, they were sent to the future. And whoever won could either return to the past and be forgiven, or stay in the future and die. So now they're time travelers and instead of aliens, which really didn't. And then also, because, like, there's, like, two or three fight scenes with Katana in the special editions, which in the original version, they kind of edited all those together into one longer fight scene. And then there's also a whole subplot that the shield, the ozone layer has repaired itself, but the government that runs the shield,
which
doesn't want anybody to find out.
Because Shield Corporation. Yeah. So
Agents of Shield. Because they're basically making money, because everyone's having to pay them to protect the Earth. So they don't want anyone to know that the shield is no longer needed. So there's a whole plot of them trying to find a spot where you can go above the shield and see that, oh yeah, we didn't die from radiation. Everything's fine.
Yeah. Blue skies.
It wasn't in like the original. It's just so bizarre.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like, I don't want to bash on this for being a bad movie, but it's...
As a standalone film, it's standard late 80s, early 90s sci-fi. If this was the first movie...
Okay.
Yeah, but that coming off the heels of the first Highlander just makes it just so bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, that's... And you know, that's the reason there were so many versions trying to patch that holes, and you know, it, you know, yeah, the Highlander franchise trying to protect its, you know, fan base and not be like, oh fuck, we screwed up on this one.
Yeah, the original theatrical, according to Wikipedia,
maybe they should have followed their own advice, and there can only be one.
Yeah. Yeah, according to Wikipedia, the theatrical edition was considered to be one of the worst films ever released.
Wow. Yeah. All right.
But we did get, you know, Michael Ironside as General Cortana, and he had some cool lines, especially like when he comes to the future and is like all of a sudden on like a subway car. He just keeps doing like crazy random stuff. And if you'll notice, in almost every film, there's a scene where an immortal is driving, and he's basically playing chicken with everybody because he knows he can't die, but the other people in the car are all freaking out. They did that in the first one when the Kurgan captured Deborah or whatever her name is. They kind of did that a little bit in this one with the Katana like takes over the freaking taxi cab. And then in the next one we'll talk about, Highlander 3 The Sorcerer, Mario Van Peebles does the same thing when he captures McCloud's kid. It's like a running gag. Like that.
I mean, it's
that just... scene has to be in every movie.
There's your continuity.
That's true, the only continuity in these films.
All right, so, you know, I don't really know what more to say about the second film. Like, it just, you know, to me, the series picked back up again with Highlander 3. Like, that was, Highlander 3, I think, was a high point for me.
I mean, Highlander 2 also had John C. McGinty in it, who's always, and he, as the head of the S.H.I.E.L.D. Corporation, kind of a dick, but he was a funny dick, so it's all right until he gets chunked out a window.
Absolutely. So, I don't know.
Oh, yeah. And also, you know, supposedly McCloud's wife, the girl from the first movie he eventually marries, was killed by radiation. And that's what motivated him to make the shield. And then you get to Highlander 3, which came out in 1994. And they've changed the story once again. And this time she died in a car accident. So they had to give him a new love interest.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, this one, I don't know. You definitely, like, this is the first film that I, you know, there's full-on nudity and stuff in. I was like.
Yeah, that, like I said, Highlander's always got him a good love scene in it. Yeah, that's, yeah, I guess that's one thing that makes, you know, immortality worth living is getting it on occasionally. but yeah, this one was directed by Andrew Morahan. And like I said, if you erase Highlander 2, this one is almost like the, should have been the sequel to the original movie.
Yeah, I mean, it was closer like to that.
I mean, it took place in New York. It, you know, it kind of fit the,
I think
fit the original storyline
a
little
bit
better.
I think it tried to bridge a lot of the gaps that the second film left open.
Yeah.
You know, there in this film, there were a lot more flashbacks to the original Highlander and, you know, a lot more, you know, things that could have tied in much more closely than, you know, what the second film alluded to. But I don't know. I thought it was cool, you know, that they, you know, some of the Japan stuff.
Yeah, because this one kind of starts with him, like, very early on going to Japan and finding basically another immortal who is a sword master. And it kind of infers that this is where, because you've always assumed that when Sean Connery showed up in the first movie, he had the cool dragon head katana, and McCloud has always used a dragon head katana, and you kind of assume that it's Ramirez's sword, but this one actually shows him getting his own katana from this, you know, Japanese sword master played by Mako that has been in a lot of like weird kung fu movies. I mean, this guy's been around forever, but he's not only immortal, he's a, like a sorcerer and a master of illusions.
Yes, and I thought that was cool, you know, when, you know, they're doing through some of their training and stuff like that, and, you know, Connor, you know, drops his sword or whatever, and it turns into the cobra and everything, and, you know.
Semen. Yeah. yeah, and he offers Highlander his head, he's like, you know, yeah, here, take my knowledge. He's like, no, I want your knowledge the old-fashioned way. He's like, teach me, I'm not going to take your head. And he's like, even for the power of illusion, nope, not going to do it.
Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of the thing is, you know, it turns into, you know, basically Kane trying to, you know, get that power.
You know? Mario Van Peebles, which I don't know what he's doing these days. He used to be like a big actor. I haven't seen him in anything in a while. But yeah, he's the bad guy of this movie, Kane, who's just kind of, you know, a warlord type character. And it's kind of, he's basically hunting immortals and trying to be the most powerful. And that's really cool because, like I said, the first one, you know, the way it ended, Connor was the one. So they got to kind of keep bringing an immortal back to fight him. And the way it happened in this one is, you know, he attacks Mako or whatever his freaking name in the movie is, and you know, tries to fight him, and Highlander escapes. But the way he built his house, studio, whatever, was inside this cave. So when it was almost booby trapped. So like when they take his head, the, like I said, the quickening is always like violent, and it basically causes a cave in and seals them all in this cave for hundreds and hundreds of years until some archaeologists dig it up, building a new power plant or something. And of course, you know, even though he's been buried for 500 years, he's, or 400 or 500 years, he's immortal. So as soon as he's unburied, we got the bad guys back, and all of a sudden, ooh, there's immortals back. But yeah, I love that because he cuts the sorcerer's head off, and he's like, "There can be only one." And his severed head is talking. He's like, "Yes, but it won't be you." Ha ha ha! And then the freaking whole cave collapses on them.
Yeah, like I felt this one, man, they use this, that line in a lot, you know, of a lot of times in this film, actually. So I was like, how many more times are we going to say there can be only one? Because it's obvious there's many more than that.
Yeah, and, you know, since Connor knows that there's going to be another fight, he tries to go back to New York because at this point he's retired, he's adopted a son, and they're living in Marrakesh or something, you know, somewhere in like you know,
Marrakesh.
Yeah. So he goes back to New York, and of course, you know, one of Kane's men shows up, and he has to, like, you know, do some head chopping, and all of a sudden they're like, oh no, like Russell Nash is back, and we just found a headless body. Cause that's not something they ever discuss in the series, but you know, when a mortal gets whacked, there's still going to be a headless body laying around. And
it's not like, oh, you're going to vanish into thin air or something like that. Like, no, there's still going to be some investigation going on.
Yeah, but instead of a forensic scientist, this time it's an actual archaeologist who's obsessed with learning about Japanese culture and the legend of this sorcerer swordsmith that, you know, she didn't believe was real, played by Deborah Unger, Dr. Alexandra Johnson, who, and of course the flashbacks, also plays Sarah, which was one of MacLeod's early love interests back during the French Revolution. So, yeah, they never explain if she's like some kind of distant relative of this girl or she just happens to like
remind her. Yeah.
They never
go into a lot of resemblance there.
Yeah. And yeah, she, of course, like, thinks MacLeod's dead because, you know, like, he goes to fight in the French Revolution and gets captured and supposedly sentenced to the guillotine. But his buddy, another immortal, is like, you know, you're too good of a soldier in this war. I'm tired of living this long. I'm going to take your place on the guillotine. But she sees him get executed and thinks it's MacLeod and goes on with her life. And when he finds her again, she's married and has a kid. So he's like, yeah, I'm just going to keep on keeping on.
I mean, at that point, what do you do? Like, I mean, that's your only choice. So,
yep. We had a couple another 100 years. There'll be another one.
Yeah.
But yeah, then there's one of the cool elements I thought of this movie was when he first fights Kane, the sword gets shattered. And so he goes back to Scotland, to where he was a blacksmith and first learned. So he's back at that original castle today. I mean, it's, the land still looks the same. I think they even filmed it in the same location. So it the hills and all that are, I mean, but he just can't, he's trying to make a sword. And he just can't come up with, you know, a workable sword. There's just not the right metal. But when this girl was, you know, investigating the original temple, she found this like block of steel that the swordsmith had kind of left for MacLeod. So she's like, this must be sword metal. And so she follows him to Scotland and
like, hey,
and gives him the brick so he can finally repair the dragon head katana.
Yes. Yeah. And that's where the love sparks. It was romantic.
Yeah, girl brings you metal for your sword. I mean, that's
love. That's love. She follows you to a foreign country. That's love.
I mean, girl brings me a sword. I mean, it's on. Yeah, screw chocolates. Bring me a sword. Woo me with weapons. That's
woo me with weapons.
That's like the secret to my heart. Bourbon and weapons.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like, this film was, you know, it bridged some of those gaps. It added a little bit of continuity to things, and I enjoyed this film.
Yeah, this one did a better job of kind of undoing what the Highlander 2 did. I mean, if you completely ignore the existence of Highlander 2, this one right here is almost the official sequel to the original movie. It's like they're like, we're not wanting to make a third. We have to number it third because it's the third movie, but we're really trying to make a true sequel to The Highlander.
Yes. Absolutely. So that brings us now to Highlander Endgame.
Which I do like, because when, of course, Kane gets the power of illusion, all the little tricks he does, just like, he sees some guys, like, you know, playing three-card Monty on the street, and he just turns, like, every card into the winning card, and they're like, and takes their money. And even steals their sunglasses. It's like, he's like such a dick as a
as an illusionist
immortal. Yeah, and then, like I said, before we get into Highlander Endgame, let's talk about the series for a minute, because Highlander Endgame is more a continuation of the story from the TV series and not kind of an official sequel to the original trilogy. Because, like I said, in that movie, really, Duncan MacLeod, played by Adrian Paul, is it's his movie. I mean, Connor happens to be in it to kind of finish out that storyline, but yeah, this is really his movie. So yeah, the series ran for 6 seasons and had a 1 season spinoff called Highlander the Raven, but this one follows Duncan MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod, which is, he's like maybe 100 years younger than Connor. And I don't think they ever do it in the series, but in this movie, they kind of like what they did with the first movie, showing a flashback to Connor's first death.
Yeah.
They do Duncan's first death, and Connor shows up to show him the ways. He's like the Ramirez character in this movie that Sean Connery was in the original. It even shows, like, you know, he's been around for a couple hundred years, so he's all, like, fancy dressed and stuff when he shows up. So he is almost that, like, you know, peacock that Ramirez was when he shows up to train Duncan.
Yes. Well, I mean, everybody's got to start somewhere, right? I mean, I don't know.
And of course, Duncan is also a at least at the start of the series, a antiques dealer and an ancient sword expert. You know, he learned that from his buddy Russell Nash. Which I think there's a great line, I think, in the Christopher Lambert shows up. It's either the first or second episode. It may not be the first episode, but it's like within the first couple episodes that he has an appearance, and he shows up in like the middle of a fight, and they're like, "Who the hell are you?" And he's like, "I'm Connor, same clan, different vintage."
Yeah, I thought that line was hilarious.
Yeah, and like I said, this is really where I got into the Highlander series. But I think because like I said, when the first one came out, I was like 7, so I wasn't. But when this came out, you know, this was like, you know, I'm under 92 to 98, so like I said, I was old enough to, like,
6-year span. Yep.
And like I said, it was heavy on the martial arts action, which I loved anything martial arts, plus the sword fighting. And like I said, I eventually went back and watched all the original films after, you know, getting into the Highlander. And man, I even had when this show was out, they had their own catalog of merchandise, the Highlander catalog. You call a number and order a catalog of all these Highlander merchandise, and pretty much you could have any of the trench coats from the show. So I have one of the, like, official Highlander trench coats.
Oh, that is awesome.
Never did buy the Dragonhead katana, but I always wanted one. And where Duncan's was like a little bit different than Connor's.
Where is that for the episode?
I know. I was like, I should have.
I was kind of that in our kilts. Like,
I was kind of disappointed. I don't know. I was a lot younger and a lot skinnier. Like, it still fits, but it doesn't quite button. It, anyway, I got to get back down to Highlander size.
Semantics. Drink like a Scotsman.
That was my problem. That's why I don't fit in my my coat anymore. I was kind of disappointed that there was no like sword rack in the coat. I'm like, if it's a Highlander coat, it should be somewhere to hang my katana.
There's a loop there, and I'm like, oh, I thought that was for a hanger. No, that's your katana loop.
Exactly. But yeah, like I said, probably, especially, you know, people of a certain age, Duncan MacLeod is probably more famous than Connor MacLeod at this point. I mean, you know, like I said, people that kind of were teenagers back in the 90s, you know, that was our Highlander.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, much to your point. You know, this is kind of what I, you know, I mean, I was still young, you know, for the TV series. So I caught the TV series, you know, for the first few years. I mean, my aunt was really big into it and stuff like that. So I got exposure to it, and that's kind of what led me to the exposure to, you know, actually check out some of the older films. So,
and even if it started with that great Queen song. That...
Yes. I mean, which is iconic. I don't know, man. Like,
I am immortal. Inside me, I have blood of kings. Yeah, and
I don't know. I'd really like to try to go back today and watch all six seasons. But
yeah, I'd like to. Like, the DVDs aren't that expensive. I'd like to order them because the video releases were always like the European editions, which were longer and actually had like a little more sex involved. Because being on American TV, you couldn't show boobs or anything like that. But if you get a hold of like the original European releases of the Highlander, they've got a little bit more adult content in them.
Oh my!
Not just sex, but more violence as well.
Suddenly, Game of Thrones comes to mind.
Exactly, but yeah, like I said, Highlander Endgame, which came out in 2000, directed by Doug Arneski, starring Adrian Paul, Christopher Lambert. In, like I said, this one was really the continuation of the series, and instead of so it, there's really no continuity with the original Highlander movies. I mean, there's some flashbacks to events from the original Highlander movie. But it's really, like I said, takes place in a different universe, I would say.
Yeah, no, and I'll say that, you know, Highlander 4, maybe it was because I was a little bit older when I watched it and everything. I will say that, you know, this was probably one of the, you know, flashback to the original, that one was very enjoyable. Highlander 4 is, you know, probably number two on my list.
Yeah, because, I mean, it had all the characters from the original series, like Joe, which was one of the Watchers who... Basically, their job—they're like the immortal historians. They follow they're humans, but they follow the immortals and kind of document their actions. And eventually, some of them choose to interfere, even though it's against the rules. And yeah, in this one, it even had the lady that was Connor's daughter in the first movie. She ends up getting killed, and he kind of goes a little crazy and decides to volunteer for this program that the Watchers. Basically, they capture a few immortals and keep them kind of in medically induced comas, protect them that way that the prize can never be won. There can never be only one. And because some people, if you know, if someone good like Connor or Duncan is the one, it could benefit humanity. But if someone, yes, like the Kurrigan or the bad guy in this movie ends up being the one, then we're all kind of screwed. So their plan was to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, and I don't know, you know, I mean, I thought that aspect of things, you know, was the dynamic that I think really made this enjoyable. Because, you know, even if somebody is an immortal or something like that, like, humanity's going to figure out, you know, I would like to think.
Yeah, Jacob Kell, played by Bruce Payne, was the bad guy for this movie. And basically, he was a priest during Connor's time, and they, like I said, Connor was kind of blamed for witchcraft when they found out he's immortal and drove him out of his village. But his mom stayed behind, and eventually they tried to burn her at the stake, and so Connor goes back to save her, fails at it, and ends up kind of wiping out half the clan and killing the guy who was kind of his Jacob's adopted father. So basically, all the bad stuff that has happened to Connor throughout the years, his wife getting killed in a car accident, you know, his shop getting blown up and his daughter being killed. It's like, basically, he's like, I've been following you throughout history, and anything that's bad that's happened has been, you know, because of me. Like, he's like, I won't kill you. I'm just going to torture you.
Well, that's kind of the thing is, you know, I mean, you look at the body count, you know, Kel had, you know, like 661 immortal kills, like Connor ended up with 262 and 174 for Duncan.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean.
That's one part, like, because he's wanting to, because basically, like I said, Connor disappears, Duncan's kind of looking for him, and he finds out he's part of this, they called it the Sanctuary, but this guy, Jacob, now has kind of like gathered a group of followers, and they violate all the rules. They don't care. They'll fight on holy ground.
Yeah.
Because like it's supposed to be one-on-one combat, but they will team up like and take you down. So they're basically hunting immortals. So he goes in and kills everybody in the Sanctuary and lets Connor free because he's like, nope, I'm just going to continue fucking with you. And so Duncan's like, I'm going to go find Connor and take this guy out. And like Joe's like, how many people have you killed? He's like, shh. Never really kept score. And he's like, well, we have. And he's like, here's the numbers. This dude's killed 600 people.
Yeah.
You may want to rethink your plan here. You're a badass, but this guy has got the kill count on you.
He's got the kill count, but like you said, you know, he's got it not following the rules of the game and stuff. Yeah. So.
And there's the whole one weird thing, because there's a girl that's part of Jacob's followers who is apparently Duncan's wife. And it's the weirdest thing, because there's a whole flashback to, I can't remember what year it is, but it's you know, France and stuff, and he meets this girl, they fall in love, and they get married, and apparently people who haven't become immortal yet, other immortals can kind of sense them, so when they get married, he's got the choice of, do I let her live out her life naturally, or do I kill her so we can be immortal forever, and he kind of chooses the selfish thing and tries to convince her being an immortal is a good thing. So after on their wedding night, after they've got it on, he stabs her to death, and she kind of takes offense of that, as most people would.
Not the most, you know, the most profound way to show your romance. Or
yeah, so she's definitely not a fan of Duncan now.
But I don't know, you know. I mean, I thought it was cool, you know. I mean. It was an interesting dynamic, you know? I mean, to have your antagonist not follow the rules of combat or the rules of engagement and everything else, I mean, it seemed much more lifelike, you know? Yeah. Like, hey, I could actually, you know, if there was this so-called game being played out, like, not everybody's going to play fairly. Yeah. Somebody's going to want to do whatever to get an upper hand, so.
See, the first time I watched this movie, I didn't really like it because being a fan of the original three, spoiler, Duncan or Connor dies in this one. Because he's basically like, neither one of us can take him down by ourselves. The rules won't let us work together. You need my knowledge. So he basically forces Duncan into taking his head to be able to be powerful enough to take down Jacob.
Yeah.
And so if you're fans of the original movies, you're like, that is fucking Connor supposed to be the one. But like I said, if you think of this as like, those first three movies did not exist. This is a continuation of the series. This is Duncan's movie. I liked it better the second time around. Like, I didn't have that hang-up that I had the initial time I watched this movie.
So, I mean, I don't know. I guess I was, you know, having seen the movies only a handful of times instead of, you know, many times to really look at it from all those angles, I never read that deep into it. But that makes, you know, a lot of sense now that, you know, we're discussing it in greater detail. Like, some of the questions and some of the holes that, you know, were like, I don't quite, you know, get it or understand. Or, you know, now it all, you know, kind of comes together more, a little bit more full circle,
I guess. And they kind of did something that they, in this movie, that they do a lot of in the series, which is whatever situation Duncan is facing now, there's always a flashback to a lesson he learned long ago that is applicable to what he's dealing with in the present. And they had this whole flashback where him and Connor are dueling, and Connor shows them this unbeatable move. It's like the if you can get someone in this configuration, this shot cannot be blocked. This is a fight ender. And again,
it's almost like you know what that reminded me of?
The Kobayashi Maru. The no-win situation.
No, the in Karate Kid.
The crane kick.
The crane, yeah. Like, you learn this one move, you can't be defeated.
Yeah, because they have that move, and then when later on when Connor and Duncan are fighting, Connor ends up trapping himself in that move because, like, so now, like, Duncan really has no choice but to take his head, and they have that, you know, moment, like, I love you, man, and now I'm going to take your head. But then when he tries that move on Kel, Kel, of course, cheats and has, like, an extra blade up his sleeve and is able to block the move, the unbeatable move. So you think Duncan's about to die, but then he kind of, like, his face morphs into Connor, and he starts talking in Connor's voice, and he's like, and that, like, throws him off enough that, you know, he's able to take him down, because he's like, you know, he's like, says in the like, I think he even said, he's like, you know, Connor's like, in Connor's voice, he's like, there can be only one, and then Duncan's voice is like, but it's not going to be you. And it was funny later, like, there's a one scene where they're in a cemetery where he's trying to goad Connor into fighting him, he's like I'm going to continue killing everyone who loves you, and he's like, you know, looks at, you know, Duncan, he's like, you're next, he's like, you know, call me. So after he chops his head off and kicks him off the building, he's like, that's me calling.
Yeah, I mean, this movie had some great lines to it.
Because Duncan was always the more wisecracking immortal. Yeah, he always had a cool line as he was, like, you know, taking somebody's head.
I mean, which, you know, I mean, by today's standards, I mean, that's important, you know?
Yeah, you got to have something cool to say when you're, you know, right before you off somebody. I mean, that's standard 90s action film stuff.
Make my day.
Yeah, where the original series was very 80s, you know. You know, Duncan, you know, was the 90s hero. And then we got something almost as bad as Highlander 2.
Yeah.
The final Highlander movie, The Source in 2007, which was so bad. It was originally meant to be a new trilogy. It never got a theatrical release. It was going to be like a sci-fi original. They aired the first one, and they, yeah, we're like, we're not doing it anymore. This is the hit. Because it jumped to the future again. Anytime they go to the future, is a bad idea.
Yeah.
It wasn't like way in the future. It was like kind of a near future where the immortals are now trying to find the source of their immortality. Like, they've convinced that being the one doesn't mean, like, being the last of us, is being the one who actually finds the source, like the holy grail of the immortals. And they're all being pursued by this guardian. So anybody who tries to find the source, this guardian will show up and kill you. And he's like this weird supernatural, super fast being. It makes no sense whatsoever.
No, I mean, if
the... I mean, Joe gets killed, which he was always one of my favorite characters in the series. Yeah. But it did have Mythos. Mythos was another cool guy from the series, which was, he was actually the oldest immortal. The guy was like 5,000 years old. He was like the oldest living immortal, and he kind of made it through life by just hiding. Like, at one point he was a priest, at one part he was like part of the Watchers. He just kind of like stayed off of everybody's radar. He's like, this is how I be the one. I just like hide the fuck out until there's only a couple of us.
I don't know. You know, I'm
which he's in one of the X-Men movies. I think he's in this X-Men 2. He's one of... the Colonel's like right hand man is the guy who plays Mythos.
I thought I recognized him.
Yeah,
it's like, all right, that kind of makes sense now.
Yeah, like I said, he that could be one of Mythos's many personalities as he's hiding.
I guess I really need to start paying more attention to movie credits because I'm apparently bad at recognizing people's faces, but. You know, I see some familiarity, and I'm like, what's going on here?
Yeah, I'm the opposite. I can't remember names for shit, but I always remember a face. I'm like, I know that guy. That guy's in this other movie.
But yeah, I don't know. I agree with your statement that this film did not do it to me. Like, you know, if there was Highlander 1, 3, and 4,
yeah,
it should have been done. Like... And it's weird, too, you know, because at the box office, you know, all the films lost movies, but yet studios were, you know, quick to, oh, yeah, let's fund this.
Like, yeah, like, theatrically, they never made a lot of money, but I think they always made money on, like, video and stuff, because most of them have become, like, a cult classic. Oh, my God, I just scrolled down on one of the Wikipedia page for Endgame. Three people that were considered for the part of Jacob Kell, Billy Idol, David Bowie, and Jean-Claude Van Damme. That would have been a different movie right there.
Jean-Claude.
Yeah, and that also had Donnie Chen, too, who's, like I said, a big, you know, kung fu action guy who's been in, like, a lot of movies, was part of Kell's crew.
So, yeah, I don't know, man. this series is kind of all over the place for me. Like, you know, I don't want to bash on it because, like you said, you know, there's a lot of nostalgia. There's, you know, a huge cult following, you know, for it. But, you know, having missed some of those high points and, you know, with the low points, it's just...
Yeah, and like I said, if you want to watch them all, watch the series and watch 1, 3, and 4. And just ignore The Source or Highlander 2.
It's like when you tell people to watch Star Wars, you know? It's like, yeah. No, forget about all the prequels.
Yeah, you watch 1 and 2, and then you go... Or, I mean, not 1 and 2, 4 and 5. Then you jump back and watch 1, 2, and 3 as a flashback, and then you watch number 6.
Or you watch them all in reverse order, and...
I think it was like, because once, you know, Darth Vader says, "I am your father," you go back and you do Vader's origin story, and then you get right back in. That's the best way to watch the original 6 films. Which I'm working on my old man Luke beard for Dragon Con. I just got to get me some Jedi robes.
You're going to do something about the red tint, too.
Like... Diet grayer. But then again, there's like one stray gray hair, so it's it may get there naturally by the time Dragon Con rolls around.
So, out of the Highlanders, which is your favorite of the films?
I mean, you can't beat the original. If you take that one off the table, I said Highlander 3 was. I did enjoy Highlander 3. I think that should have been the sequel instead of Highlander 2. Yeah. Like I said, if they had never done Highlander 2 and that was the official second movie. Like I said, it was awesome. Like I said, I had too many hangups on when Endgame came out. That I was like, no, like Connor shouldn't die. But like I said, if I'd never seen any of the original films and just watched the series, then yeah, that's a very good movie too. Let's see, out of all, who is your favorite non-McLeod character in the Highlander series?
Man, that one's kind of tough. I mean,
my favorite Highlander has to be Duncan. Like I said, because that's where I started with it was the series, and then went back into the movies.
I think it's Duncan, you know, for me as well.
Yeah, but if we're doing a non McLeod, I would have to either go with Mythos because he was always cool. Because he was kind of like I'm so old that I don't give a shit about anything anymore. Yeah, he was always the wise, like smartest. Like I've been around longer than you, so you should listen to me. Or Joe, the watcher. He was always kind of a cool dude. And like later on, he like quit being a watcher and opened up a bar, like a jazz bar. He would play guitar and serve drinks and, you know, give McLeod his opinion on stuff, which was always kind of cool. Like I was like, I want to hang out in this bar and get drunk with immortals.
Awesome. That could be a thing. Could we open up a bar called Immortals and
a Highland? I mean, there's a bar recently opened up that was themed from what is it? The old Harrison Ford movie where he's hunting the replicants.
Oh shit! Hold on.
But yeah, that was a theme for a bar. I mean, why can't we make a Highlander bar?
Well, isn't there a bar in Atlanta called Highlander?
Yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with... I think it is like a Scottish pub, but yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with the movie. But yeah, some like immortal chicken wings or something. Yeah, we can do like all kind of...
Blade Runner.
Yeah, Blade Runner. I'm having a brain fart. I can't remember the name of that damn movie. But yeah, that's... we need to make a... And then, which I've not really watched it, but there was also an animated series that was like took place in the future with a different... I think it was like... I can't remember. It was a different McLeod, but yeah, it was a McLeod in the future, which, like I said, went on for a little while. Which I never really saw that. And there when the series ended, there was a spinoff called Highlander the Raven, which followed the antics of one of Duncan's friends, which was a female immortal who was a thief, but that only lasted like one season.
Yeah, I forgot what the I think it was The Watcher, wasn't it? Was it the sixth film? I don't remember.
I can't remember the name of the animated movie. It was like something like The Quest for Vengeance or something. But yeah, it was like I said, kind of a weird animation style. So, have you come up with your favorite character? Or what's your favorite movie, if that's an easier one to...
I mean, my favorite movie by far is, the third film. I liked a lot of the jokes and everything that it brought to the table. The original would be, next in line, just because that's the origin and the cult following. Endgame is, probably third on my list, and the other two I kind of wish never happened.
So as we wrap up, final thoughts on the cigar?
This cigar is interesting. It starts out, I would say very much full body, and then it mellows out as you, so it's, I'm finding it, like, there at the beginning, it was a powerhouse. Like, all right, I'm smoking a full cigar. I would almost say now that with the halfway point and then the final third, I'm smoking more of a medium cigar. So it was kind of nice to have that upfront power and then it mellow out and bring you down as you continue smoking.
Yeah, very, very well constructed. And it's a very slow burning cigar too. I mean, we're an hour into this and I'm still maybe got only halfway through. So yeah, this is definitely a damn good cigar. You should go pick one up.
Yeah, no, I like I said, I've never had anything bad by Tatawahe. I don't remember smoking the 2013 release. We may have at some point. I just don't. I've smoked so many cigars now that it's hard to keep track of.
I'll start blending together.
Yeah, like, I'm scared. And then there's so many different versions, to say, oh yeah, I've smoked the Tatawahe, but which one did you smoke? Skinny Monster, Pudgy Monster, a TAA?
Well, that's the thing with a lot of these TAAs. They kind of keep the blend similar and just kind of mess with the different Vitolas and sizes and stuff. So I think this one, they said, is like the same as the 2012 edition. But with that, we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
He is immortal. Born in the Highlands of Scotland 400 years ago, he is not alone. There are others like him, some good, some evil. For centuries, he has battled the forces of darkness, with holy ground his only refuge. He cannot die unless you take his head and with it his power. In the end, there can be only one. He is Duncan MacLeod, the Highlander.
Hey man, it's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Booze Hounds return.
And welcome back to the podcast. It's drinking time. So, what are we drinking this week, if you can pronounce it?
Oh, man. This week we are drinking the Sammy Claus. For folks that don't know much about this beer...
Sammy Claus.
Let me just go ahead and tell you that it is 14% ABV.
At one point, it was the strongest beer in the world. I mean, there's been some stuff released out. I think there's you can get up to a 30% now. But at one point, this was the strongest beer in the world.
But, this beer is interesting because it's brewed once a year on December 6th, and it's aged 10 months before bottling. This is probably one of the rarest beers in the world outside of maybe, some of the ones that you're talking about with the, 20-30%
nuclear tactical penguin or whatever it is.
Yeah. One of the interesting things is that this beer can actually be aged in the bottle for many years. And, the more you age, the more that the beer becomes complex, creamy, with a warm finish is how it's described on the bottle. It's recommended to be served with hearty, robust dishes and desserts, particularly with chocolate, or just as an after-dinner drink by itself, which is what we're having. Although we do have an abundance of chocolate in the fridge.
Yeah, we should get that rest of that bunny out.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, this thing is... It's stout, but it doesn't have that... That alcohol tends to it that the high gravity stuff has. It's very smooth.
I don't know. I will say that this beer is very good. I will caveat by saying this beer is very dangerous. Because you get just a hint of the alcohol, but it's sweet. It's got a lot of, you know, hints of banana, vanilla. You know, just it's odd because it doesn't drink like a 14%. Yeah. You know, like what you would expect a barley wine or, you know, some other, you know, 13-14%. This is, you know, drinks more like a beer that is 8, maybe 9%.
Yeah, and it's according to the bottle, it's made by Castle Brewery, but the official name is Bayerisches Schloss in Edinburgh. Yeah, it's an Austrian beer, and if you actually try to look up information on this, they do have a website and a Facebook page, but they're both in Swiss German. So unless you're want to Google Translate everything you're reading, it's like I said, there's a paragraph about the beer on the website, but none of us can read it. So if any of our German listeners out there can translate. Or Austrian, yeah. Go to the website and tell us what they said about this beer because I couldn't decipher that.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, one of the interesting things about this beer is when you hold it up to the light, the clarity of the beer. Like that's one thing that really stands out. Like you don't.
Yeah, it's a dark brown, but it's very clear.
But yeah, you know, it's. I mean, you know, this is the. You know, probably truest form of a lager that I can think of. You know, I mean,
it almost looks like a whiskey or something. It's got that dark brown to it.
But you know, I mean, I can't say enough good things about this. This is my first time having this beer. I'm going to pick up another couple of bottles just to, you know, throw them in a wine cellar.
Yeah,
throw them in the dark and let them age for a while, and you know, see how they turn out. You know, yeah, I mean, this is bottled in 2013, so I mean, this is already aged for 3 years.
Yeah, like, and someone's theory was it's named Sammy Claus because after you drink one, you're too drunk to say Santa Claus, so it comes out Sammy Claus. Which I did watch somebody chug one night on a bet, and yeah, he went from like zero to drunk like real quick.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, that's the thing about this, man, is I could turn my glass up and not stop drinking, but I know, you know, within 3-4 minutes, like, all that alcohol is going to hit me like a ton of bricks.
Yeah, if you drunk one of those bombers by yourself, this is one to be like, you know, one and done. You're drunk.
I gotta say, like, I was expecting, you know, there to be a hint of the alcohol and everything else, but man, this drinks. No,
this is why this is dangerous, because it doesn't have any of that alcohol burn that you kind of get with some of the higher gravity or barley wines. It's way too smooth drinking. So if you're not paying attention or not realizing what you're drinking, this will get you quick.
Yeah, well, I guess maybe that's the comment when I went to pick up the bottle and the guy's like, oh yeah, this will get you where you want to be.
Yeah, shout out to Dawson Fine Wine. We've been picking up a lot of our beers lately. For a Dawsonville liquor store, they definitely got a good selection of beers and whiskeys that you don't see in most stores.
And to give folks a little bit of an idea.
And a very knowledgeable staff, too. When we go in there looking for beers to review, they've always got, you know, a good explanation of everything and can steer you in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to give folks an idea of Dawsonville that may not be, you know, familiar with that area, you know. There is no Publix.
Not yet. We're building one. We're finally getting one. Yeah, but it is country as fuck.
So, you know.
There's a highway that goes through Dawsonville, but once you get off that highway, it's country as fuck.
But, man, I got to say, this was a pleasant surprise all the way around. Just absolutely phenomenal beer. I mean, this... I don't know, man. You look up the definition of lager, and I don't see how you get a better candidate than this one. So, I'm absolutely in love with this thing.
Yeah, go pick it up while you can. What's currently available, or you're going to have to wait till next year's edition.
Screw that. Don't pick it up. Save it for me.
All right, give it a week, and then go pick up whatever Brad left you.
Like,
so,
I mean, that's the bad thing, man, is you discover an awesome beer, you tell people how awesome it is, and then all of a sudden one or two things happens. Either everybody sold out of said beer, or the price skyrockets. Like, dude, I can remember Dragon's Milk. I was buying Bomber you know, $6.50, $7 a bottle. Now I can't find it for less than $15.
Yeah. That's like some of the cigars. Was it the Asian Room at 55 when it came out? Was like a number one cigar, but nobody knew about it, and you could find them pretty cheap. And like now, it's like if you can find them, you're going to pay a premium for them because everyone found out that they were so awesome.
Thanks, cigar aficionado.
I mean, the only cigar I can remember recently that hasn't had that effect is the New Worlds by AJ Fernandez. That one, like, they haven't gone up in price, and you can usually still find them everywhere. They've definitely not gotten greedy with their reputation.
Yeah, but you know, as far as the beer goes, and I'm just going to throw it out there. If you haven't already figured it out by my voice and my description, I'm at a solid 5.
Sounds good. And with that, we'll drink another one or the rest of one and be right back.
Stay tuned.
Might be a little drunk during science, but if I start slurring, it's because of this segment.
Yes, science!
And welcome back. It's time for science. You ready to get technological up in here?
I don't know, dude. I'm still trying to recover from this beer.
Yeah, it's...
So far, I haven't been able to get my mind off of it.
Yeah, this might be an interesting segment.
It might be if you drink up.
Speaking of driving and drinking, as we know, driverless cars... I'm already slurring my speech. Driverless cars is a thing that's, you know, definitely, you know, currently happening, but... You know, by 2020, they said there's going to be a lot of them on the road. And a new study published in the journal Science, basically there's a question of moral computers. When we are no longer in control of a vehicle and basically a Kobayashi Maru happens where the car is like detected an accident it can't really avoid, should it kill its passengers and not kill, like, say you're driving down the road, a bunch of kids run out in front of you. Should the car sacrifice itself and you as the passenger, or hit the pedestrian? I mean, a lot of, you know, cars now have like the auto brakes and stuff where if it detects an impact before you do, it'll apply the brakes, but you're still in control of driving that vehicle. When we give up that control, you know, there's the question of who should the car save?
But as a driver, and in that scenario, everything happens so fast. Are you really, making a conscious decision on what you're about to do, or does the body's natural panic reaction dictate the action you take, whether it's to avoid impact and, you know, crash into an oncoming semi or something, or, you know, take out a tree? You know, do you really have that level of control?
Yeah, but with the robotic cars, essentially, you know, they're going to be able to see an obstacle, and even though it applies the brakes, it can calculate that distance faster than we can. Yes. And know that we're not going to be able to stop. So do I swerve to oncoming traffic or run off the road and hit something, or do I just lock the brakes down and protect my passengers and take out whoever's in front of us? And that's one kind of a struggle in programming these eventual cars that programmers are coming to gunch at. You know, they did a survey to get the public's opinion on it. And 75% of people, first said, the car should save as many people as possible. So if the math says, you know, either one person's going to die or five person's going to die, choose the one person. But when they ask that same question, in that scenario, are you willing to be the passenger? People's answers change. So you know, the humans can't really make that decision themselves. You know, because you should protect yourself at all costs. But like I said, they kind of dealt with it in that movie. Was it I, Robot? That's one of the reasons Will Smith didn't trust robots is because he was in a car accident and a robot made a decision that he had a greater chance of survival, so I should save him instead of the little girl that's in the other car. And, you know, a human person would probably, you know,
have chosen go for
the
latter.
Go for the little girl. So it's kind of a moral quandary that has come up in developers.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know how you I mean, I could see that as a driver, as a single, you know, occupant, that, all right, you know, take me out if it's for the greater good. But, you know, put a family in that situation.
And that was another...
Save the family.
Yeah, that was another one. You know, people's answers also change when they're like, all right, it's not just you in the car, it's you and your kid. Now what's the correct choice? Like I said, the answers keep changing depending on the situation where, you know, you or I in that situation, it may happen too fast for us to consciously make a decision, but,
yes.
But you know, human instincts and reactions are, you know, are going to play a part. But when that decision's completely out of your control and it's a computer going on math alone.
Or the computer says, screw it, human, take the wheel. And
yeah. I'm applying the brakes. The steering wheel is yours. Decide what you want to do.
I don't know. For the religious folks, you know, this may be, you know, one Jesus, of those opportunities where, you know, all right, computer's human out of the element. Jesus, this is all on you, buddy. Do your will.
Have you ever heard, I can't remember his name right now, but there's a comedian that has a whole bit on the whole Jesus take the wheel song, and he's like, that's a bad decision. You're letting go of the steering wheel in a car accident, and it's like, what if Jesus is busy? No, keep your hands on the wheel and steer into the skid.
What if Jesus and God gave us the ability to avoid the accident, but we don't take that initial wheel and try to, you know, like, I don't know, it's kind of, you know, like that joke, like, it, you know, there's a flood or something, and you know,
oh, yeah, with the person
says,
on the roof.
Know, trapped on the roof, and it's like, you know, a boat comes by. Nope, Jesus will save me. A helicopter, you know, swerves in. Nope, you know, God's going to save me. You know, finally, like, some rescuers show up. Nope, it's in God's hands. God's going to save me. The preacher dies, and it's like, come on, God, you said you'd be there. It's like, I sent you a helicopter, a boat, and, you know, rescuers. What more do you want me to do?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's something that's going to kind of, you know, have to be decided once we give up our driving abilities and give it into the, you know, robots' hands. Speaking of robots, Boston Dynamics, or as I like to call them, Skynet, the designers
I think
we've
talked about these guys before, have we not?
Oh yeah, they've been making creepy ass robots for a long time. I mean, this is how we get Terminators. One of the designs we talked about earlier was
our Barkinators.
Was the Spot Rope, which was their robot dog that basically was basically like a military pack animal. You can mount all kind of stuff on it. Well, they've come out with a smaller version called the Spot Mini, which is basically supposed to be designed for helping around the house. It's a smaller version of the Spot Bot with running off electric motors. It can operate up to 90 minutes on a charge. But this thing looks creepy as shit, because it has basically a robot arm that has a gripper on it that kind of, it has two little cameras in it, so it looks like a face. And it's so creepy, because the arm
like
can
the
be...
the body of a dog with the neck of a giraffe. Like.
Yeah, it looks like some like weird robotic dinosaur. But yeah, in the demo video, there's like, where it's showing the ability of the head to... gyro-stabilized, where the body can move where the head doesn't. So the body's all jumping around like an excited dog does, but the head stays perfectly still, and that's kind of creepy. But yeah, this thing can, like, you know, help out in the kitchen. In the video, they show it, like, picking glasses off the counter and putting them in the dishwashers, picking up garbage, throwing it away.
I'm kind of watching a GIF image, you know, of the head being stationary. I gotta say,
it's
man.
It's a thing,
like,
of nightmares.
No, dude, like, you take this dog to a club on the dance floor, like... Nah, man.
Yeah, you put some dubstep in this video? Yeah. I mean, this dog's getting laid that night. Oh, yeah. And like I said, I could see this being helpful, like we're, you know, in a disabled person's household that might need something to get up and, you know, cook or clean or whatnot. And so it's definitely got good applications, but yeah, it's just weird looking. And then later in the video, I guess they have the production, because the demo video is all just kind of like a bare skeleton, but in the production models, that has kind of a plastic body on it. And it's all white. It makes it look like freaking if stormtroopers had pets. I mean, this would be a stormtrooper's dog. It's very weird.
Yeah, I don't know how that would help, though, because whatever it was trying to do, it would just miss its intended goal.
Maybe that's what they need. They need a stabilized dog to shoot for them.
Yeah, I could see that being a thing. Yeah, because that's the thing that you know came to mind when I saw it retrofitted with the white body and everything. Was like, man, we're gonna get some future Star Wars, and you know all the stormtroopers are gonna have a squad dog. Because, bitch, they operate.
Yeah, I mean, the military has canine units. Stormtroopers should have robot canine units.
But, I mean, definitely an awesome concept, though. Like, I don't know. I mean, you know, watching it navigate steps or, you know, there's one scene where it's navigating a kitchen and people have chairs pulled out and everything. Like, it is just awesome, you know, watching the dog, you know, go through, you know, all the obstacles and everything else. And, you know, so much as to pick up a glass, gyro it around, place it in the dishwasher. Like, you know, if you, you know, extend this ability to somebody that may be, you know, visually impaired or something to that effect, like, you know, I could see this being a huge asset and a huge benefit to somebody in that, you know, circumstance.
Speaking of animals, an Australian scientist have recently done a study on animals. Basically, they're getting animals high for science. Carolyn Lee, one of the researchers, in a recent article published in Biological Letters, basically, you can't really tell if your animal is suffering from anxiety. Like humans, we get sweaty palms, stutter maybe, whatnot. But animals, there's no real clear sign. So that's one of the things they're trying to figure out is if there's a way to figure out if animals are anxious or not. Yeah, this kind of has implications in like livestock and stuff. You know, if your livestock's freaked out, it's not going to eat as well. You know, it's going to be detrimental to its health. So it's trying to come up with a scientific way to tell whether or not, you know, you need to calm an animal down.
And don't, you know, like animals, like usually if there's a predator or something nearby, like, don't they usually like tend to look in that direction? Like I know with deer, for instance, we used to have them come into the
like a deer
yard and stuff all the time.
A deer stuck in headlights is kind of the example.
You know, and they look and they stare, you know, and, you know, then they make a decision like, all right, you know, if you're stationary, maybe they're going to scope you out for 5 or 10 seconds, but then they're going to dart.
Well, that reaction is actually called observation bias, I believe it is, which it's something that humans do as well. What it is if you are experiencing a moment of high anxiety, you will tend to look at things that freak you out longer than you would if you were calm. So they wanted to test to see if this was a thing in animals as well. So what they did was take a herd of 60 sheeps, and sheep are sheeps, I'm not sure how what the plural of sheep is. And they split them into three groups. The control group, no, you know, chemicals added. One group of 20, they gave Valium and got them stoned. And the other group, they gave a drug that's basically a knockoff version of ecstasy. So they gave freaking sheep raver drugs. And
did they play dubstep and wait on the drop?
They might have. So in their experiment, they had they're in a room eating, and they basically opened up a curtain, and there was a dog. They found the control group stared at the dog for, you know, 10, 15 seconds, whatever. The group that was on ecstasy stared at it for, like, double that amount of time. And the group that was stoned barely noticed it at all. In fact, one sheep didn't even notice it because it was so hot. It was so stoned. So they have determined that, yes.
And that's why we have, you know, driving under the influence. That does not just mean alcohol.
Yeah, so they have determined that the observation bias is something that also exists in animals. Yeah, and they also determined that sheep do get the munchies, because apparently you know, the group that was stoned ate a lot more than the other two groups, and the group that was high like did not want to eat at all. So the munchies is a thing even in the animal kingdom.
Well, I mean, you know, if nothing else, at least science has proved that. I don't know, man. Like, I still kind of feel like that's borderline, like, I don't know. Like, introducing chemicals like that to sheep and stuff. Like, I don't know. I tend to like animals more than people. It's like, can't we take a bunch of convicted, like, rapists or murderers or something and experiment with them? Like, can that be a thing?
But, you know, how bad is getting an animal stoned? I mean,
it's
probably fun.
It's fun for us.
People enjoy ecstasy. I mean, yeah, some sheeps get a little high. It's all good. And maybe that'll calm them down when they're getting sheared later to make a wool. You know, just get them really stoned.
Jesus.
You know, in the next experiment, they should get a bunch of fainting goats and get them stoned and see if they, you know, don't faint as much. Calms them down.
They're just in a perpetual state of faint.
Here's an experiment done on humans. Recently, Dr. Rachel Petchy, maybe, basically studying different forms of drinking, have determined that a larger glass actually makes you drink faster and more. They did an experiment over a time period at a bar where they replaced the normal wine glasses with bigger wine glasses. You know, they didn't increase the amount of alcohol. It was the same amount of alcohol, just in a bigger glass. And they found that that alcohol sales actually went up in the bar when they used the larger glasses. For some reason, people drank faster and ordered more drinks, I guess because it was a perceived getting a smaller amount of alcohol.
Well, no, I almost wonder if it isn't the exact opposite and the perceived that you're actually getting, you know, more alcohol, you know, depending on the price point. Like, I know, you know, like, oftentimes, like, you know, you go to a bar and they give you a pint glass. Well, you know you're going to get a pint of beer, but you go, you know, somewhere and they offer you, like, a, you know, freaking boot or something like that, which can be, you know, 2 or 3 liters, like, you're typically going to consume more because that perceived value, like, to get 3 liters, ordering a pint at a time is going to be much more expensive than getting that entire, you know, 3 liters in one go.
One thing is, like, they really didn't even increase the amount of alcohol. Yeah. It was just a bigger glass. And they even did where they decreased the size of the glass, so it actually looked like there was more alcohol, and there really wasn't that big of a change from the standard wine glass. But for some reason, the bigger glass actually increased alcohol consumption. So
I should get us some very tiny beer glasses? Like, we should go to the sampling glass size? And
well, apparently that really doesn't affect them. But they did, in cases of beer, they did find that serving beer in a curved glass actually increased alcohol sales versus in the standard, like, mug, straight glass. So that's when you go to Applebee's and you get the big Brutus glass. You tend to, I guess, pound a few more of those if you're instead of drinking the standard pint or, you know, mug of beer.
Huh, that's kind of interesting. I wonder, you know, what the psychological, you know, aspect of that, why that, you know, occurs. And
I don't know, I guess, like, seeing what you perceive as less in a glass, you're like, oh, I've got to drink more to get to that same level of drunk, where I can drink 3 regular wines, but since I'm drinking this smaller wine, I better get 4 or 5, but I'm still actually consuming the same amount of alcohol.
Yeah, so, I mean, it may not be, you know, necessarily the drunk, more so than just you maybe, you know, perceive that you're consuming less, so you think you can have more, you know, whereas if it's I don't know, like,
I'm going to have to bring out my giant beer mug I have that holds 5 beers. See if that increases.
I'm too drunk to drink. Well, then.
Oh, I've only got 1 beer in this 5-beer glass. That means I should have, like, you know, more of these.
I'm sorry, officer. I've only had, like, 2 beers tonight, which, you know, I mean, they were 1 liter apiece.
Yeah, that's why you drink from a pitcher. Technically, it's only 1 beer. Yeah. I only had 1 beer tonight, officer. And also, if anyone's watched the movie The Martian, where Matt Damon grows, you know, food in space, Dutch scientists have been experimenting to see if we can actually grow food on Mars and it be edible. Because Martian soil is a lot different than our soil. There's a lot more heavy metal content in the soil that could be harmful to humans. And they've found some foods do kind of collect that extra toxin from the soil, but there is a lot of things that we can potentially grow in space that they're not affected by the toxins in Martian soil. So, but as Elon Musk wants us to build this, you know, space resort on Mars in the next couple of years, you know, we can still grow tomatoes and whatnot in space.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I don't know. You know, I'm kind of a little bit of a stickler when it comes to food. You know, I like to know where my food is sourced and that kind of thing. And that really goes back to, you know, like we started getting genetically modified, you know, vegetables and that kind of stuff. And, you know, now it's, you know, adding the additional hormones in milk and meats and everything. And people's like, man, why are, you know, people hitting puberty so much earlier? Or, you know, why is, you know, I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, the introduction to hormones and stuff that would not be found, you know, in, you know, a typical farmer's, you know.
That's one of the things, too, you know, if we're going to build some kind of self-sustaining colony on Mars, we're eventually going to have to grow food there. You know, it's not economically feasible to keep transporting food to Mars. So eventually, you know, for a base to, you know, be sustainable, you're going to have to grow some kind of food there. But the one thing that the experiment doesn't account for is, I'm not sure what the level of solar radiation, because the atmosphere, I think, is a lot thinner on Mars than it is on Earth. So you've got to be getting higher radiation content from the sun than you do here on Earth. So I'm wondering if that will affect eventual plant growth on Mars. And, you know, if the food's freaking radioactive, it doesn't matter if it hasn't picked up any toxin from the soils, you're still not going to be able to eat it.
I don't know. Lots of iodine pills, I suppose.
Fallout New Vegas, baby.
Fallout New Mars, not to be confused with the old uninhabited Mars.
Well, that's one of the things that NASA's been putting out these, like, we want you for Mars posters. Basically, they're saying the first group of Martian explorers, it's a one-way trip. So eventually, they're going to start recruiting people to go to Mars that, you know, you're not coming back. You're going to go there, you're going to colonize, but there's no way for us really to bring you back to Earth once you get there.
Yeah, I don't know. That takes a serious level of commitment. But, you know, I don't know, dude. Like, you played the Doom games much?
Yeah. We may find demons on Mars.
Yep.
Hell, Earth kind of sucks. I mean, I'd volunteer for that mission. I'm probably not in the best health to, like, no. We're like, no, you're too fat for the spaceship. We need skinny, healthy humans. Like, come on, bro. There's got to be a fat guy on Mars.
They could feed off of me. You know, if shit goes south, I could be the force that keeps everybody alive.
I'm going to put that in my eventual NASA application. I'm like, hey, you need, like, if food runs out and we have to event to cannibalism, you need at least one fat guy on the team. Like, I may keep the team alive for another week or two. If it's a bunch of skinny people, they're going to go a lot quicker. That's all I'm saying.
Damn.
And with that, we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Siri. I would never, never, ever listen to the Earth Station 1 podcast. Who the heck says howdy anyway? Why don't you listen to Chris Hardwick instead? I can get you his information. The Nerdist is everywhere anyway, haha. That was a joke. The Earth Station 1 podcast. It's time to let your inner geek out to play. You can find them at www.earthstation1.com or up on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or wherever fine podcasts are found. Peace, and we're done.
And now it's time for all things nerdy in Nerd News.
And welcome to Nerd News.
Yeah, news.
All right, so to forewarn everybody, we're going to open this with probably the most offensive, disgusting, most brilliantly and epic thing that we've seen all summer. Quite possibly all of our lifetimes.
Before we end that, we've kind of had an idea for a new segment that we're not ready to fully release, but we're talking about doing maybe a small movie review segment when something comes out that we think is awesome, but we don't want to do a whole episode on it. So we don't even really have a title for it yet, but just give you an example of what we're going to talk about. We're going to do a little quick movie review here at the start of Nerd News and talk about Range 15.
Yeah, so this was directed by Ross Patterson. And, you know, for folks that aren't familiar with this you know, film, you know, basically it, you know, surrounds itself with veterans and, you know, people from all walks of life and, you know, just basically started out as a event. So, you know, basically TUG was utilized, which is a service that, you know, theaters can say, hey, if this movie sells X number of tickets, then we'll do a showing.
And based on like the whatever sales per screen, it was actually the number two comedy in the country last week, which is pretty awesome for something, you know, independently made.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So it's awesome from the fact that not only does it, you know, have the veteran background and the support for those men and women and pay homage to them, and you know, it's you know, which just from a civilian standpoint, I can say that there's been no other film that I've sat through a theater and, you know, laughed so wholeheartedly at.
Oh, like, yeah, you know, we laughed our ass off at that movie. It's so over the top, ridiculously awesome. I mean, it's just basically a bunch of like crazy buddies happen to get drunk one night and wake up in the middle of the zombie apocalypse. And they're dudes like us that are like trying really hard not to be excited about the zombie apocalypse because now we can fuck up people for no reason.
It's hard to say you're not excited. I wish a motherfucker would.
Exactly. That's the theme of the movie.
So, I mean, you know, just the dynamic and the you know, the jokes. I mean, if you're military, you know, what a lot of people have been saying and, you know, said that, you know, oftentimes when you come back from deployment or whatever, most civilians don't quite understand the humor. And, you know, there's a lot of cynicism, you know, perceived by civilians and stuff from that standpoint.
I mean, it's basically one of those where you have to laugh to keep yourself, like, sane. I mean, I was never in the military, but in law enforcement, we have a very similar, you know, comic sense, because it's like you see such jacked up stuff all the time, you have to make fun of it or the stress will get you. So yep. So when people think we all have like this sick twisted sense of humor, I mean, that's our stress coping mechanism.
No, absolutely. And this film really depicted that. I mean, you know, the film is brilliant, but I gotta say, you know, for folks that are going to, you know, hear about how great this movie is and maybe didn't get a chance to see it in theaters, there's going to be a DVD release. And, you know, the post credits, you know, where, you know, you see double there was a clip from amputees and stuff from like that.
Apparently they're also releasing a feature length documentary on the making of the movie that's also going to be released later this year. And that's almost worth watching as much as the movie, just seeing what all went into these guys making this thing. I think was it Nick Palmisano, one of the guys from Ranger Up, who's in the movie. He had a thing to say where he's like, "This movie's for the veteran community. It's not for everybody. If you like it, great, but it doesn't have to be for you. If you don't want it to be for you, if you don't like it, go fuck yourself."
Yeah. And I mean, I think ultimately that was kind of
or something like that.
That was, you know, kind of a big, you know, running theme of the movie. I mean, you know, this is, you know, by veterans, for veterans, and, you know. Yeah.
But the intention, but like I said, we're not veterans and we laughed our ass off at that movie. So anybody who likes a good time and can stand some dirty jokes and just ridiculousness. Do you have to see this movie when you
Uber
get the opportunity?
Uber debauchery. Yeah. I loved it.
You know? And I got to say, Vince Vargas Rocco is my hero. I want to be him when I grow up. Because I've stolen so many of his lines from the movie and used them in real life that it's...
I mean, that's because you're already big as shit.
Exactly. Bro, I'm big as shit. Nothing's going to hurt me.
Exactly. So,
all right, you know. So what else we got in the news? So, anyway, you've been reading Ross's book. How do you like that?
Well, I absolutely love Range 15, but, you know, I got to say, man, I think there's a little bit of a St. James Street James in all of us. I mean, just, I don't know, man. Ross Patterson might be my new hero. I mean, just the...
Yeah, they do not sponsor us, but he has a book out called At Night She Cries While He Rides His Steed that is... They bill it as the... first romance novel for dudes, and it's absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, so if you're into all things manly, I do encourage you to get this book. You know what? If you're not getting this book, then that probably explains why you're not getting laid. So, if that tells you anything.
Okay, now we're going to have to start the Cigar Nerds Book Club segment.
Hey, man, you know, it might be a great opportunity to do it.
As much as we read, though, we'll have like one book a year. It'll be an annual thing instead
of
a month.
But, man, it's going to be a fucking epic book. So, something else that's pretty fucking epic is, you know, Netflix did this little thing with Daredevil Season 2 that, you know, introduced a character, you know.
You mean Punisher Season 1?
way to steal the thunder, asshole. You know, but yeah, it was very interesting, you know, that, you know, season two of Daredevil was basically Punisher season one because it's so heavily focused on that character. Well, you know, the rumor started flying and everything that, oh yeah, Netflix is going to be doing a Punisher series, blah, 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 blah. Well, according to IMDb, the release date for Punisher, the Netflix series, is going to be November 2017. I don't know about you folks, but for me, that kind of struck me as odd. I was like, they've already done the intro. What more do they need to fucking do? Like, you know, well, let's get this shit rolling.
So many things has to come out before then because we've got Luke Cage coming up this fall.
Stop making excuses.
Well, we got Luke Cage coming out this fall, and I believe we got another Jessica Jones season next year. So they got a few things already on the books that they got to get through.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm excited for Luke Cage. Jessica Jones season one was really good.
Or Iron Fist, whenever that comes
out. Yeah, Iron Fist.
The next thing after Luke Cage.
Yep. Anyway, keep you know, following the news. Check it out. Netflix hasn't come out with an official that this is going to be the release date, but it's the first release that I've seen, you know, posted. And IMDb can usually be a pretty credible source.
Speaking of Netflix, if you haven't watched the new Voltron yet, go watch that. It's freaking amazing.
Yes, I do love the updated animation style, the graphics. And, you know, it felt like Voltron to me. So, yeah. You know, I don't know. I keep following different sites and hearing different opinions, and you know, there's always the haters out there that are going to be like, oh, you guys are just nostalgia, reliving your childhood, blah blah blah. Maybe so, but we had a fucking epic childhood. So all you other pussies, shut up. I think that's part of what's wrong with today's generation. They didn't grow up with great cartoons like we did.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much political correctness and wussification and everything else that I think that's directly attributed to, you know, people's, you know, mentality.
Yeah, I went to
the softness.
A family pizza place the other day, and they always have, like, the Cartoon Network on. And seeing, like, the cartoons kids watch nowadays, I'm like, what is this crap? Yes. I'm like, I can't even, like, comprehend it.
You've all gone soft. Red Foreman for president. Go put a foot in the ass. all right, up next, Forrest Whitaker's Rogue One character is, going to be based on a character from Star Wars, the Clone Wars, the animated series. So, you know, I was kind of excited about that. I didn't really know if how that was really going to tie in. So, you know, the fact that he got cast and everything, and that is Saul Guerrera.
I think so. Like I said, it's been a long time since I've seen that episode. But yeah, basically he was like they were underground, like, resistance fighters that was trained by Anakin, him and his sister, and apparently, like, his sister dies and he kind of goes terrorist against the the Empire, which, hey, do what you gotta do.
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the things I liked about his character is, you know, he kind of had the over-the-top tactics and stuff, and I think that's what made his character pretty good, so... I don't know. Excited for that. Up next is...
but also...
Ooh!
The return of Darth Vader.
Not the king?
No. But yeah, as long as we're talking about Rogue One, it has been confirmed that not only is Darth Vader back in this movie, James Earl Jones has returned to voice Darth Vader.
Yes, that was another exciting bit of news. I forgot about that, actually. Like, I was like, how are they going to do Rogue One but not include Darth Vader?
Yeah, because, I mean, it takes place in the time frame that Vader would have been the big bad, so...
Yep. So, former Wonder Woman, Linda Carter, has been confirmed for the Supergirl. You know, people will know Linda Carter from her 1970s, Wonder Woman TV series that she was in.
And also in Super Troopers.
And Super Troopers, yes.
As a governor. So it's kind of funny. Her role has been announced that she will be playing the President of the United States. So I kind of wanted to be her character from Super Troopers has, you know, moved up in rank in the last couple of years and now has been elected president. But she was the governor of whatever state that took place in.
I don't know. I could do some epic montages that I think would be great, but I don't know. We'll just have to see. So another little thing that came out, you know, there's a bunch of hublaba surrounding some, you know, Ghostbusters all women duo movie, some thing that just doesn't seem to be suiting my fancy. Anyway, the theme song for the newest Ghostbusters movie has been released, you know, done by Fall Out Boy and Missy Elliott, of all people. I was like, how does that tie in? Like,
it's bad.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, people are actually surprised. Like, I don't understand. Why is it getting so much hate? We love Fall Out Boy and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, man, I still to this day can, you know, roll through a parking lot, you know, blasting the original Ghostbuster theme, getting thumbs up and everything.
Exactly.
You know, I feel like I'll get my ass beat if I, you know, roll through trying to play out some Fall Out Boy or some
shit. It sounds like a bad emo cover of the original Ghostbusters theme with a rap segment added for some reason. I mean, there was no rap segment in the original. It kind of reminds me a little bit of the opening theme from the Ghostbusters Extreme animated series, but still, that was a better song than this.
Yes.
I think I seen it best. One of my friends posted, Danny posted, it was like, Fall Out Boy, because the song is Ghostbusters, I'm Not Afraid. And she posted, like, Fall Out Boy, You're Not Afraid. You will be. You will be.
I don't know. I'm afraid. I'm afraid for my eardrums. That was not pleasant. I don't know, man. It just, you know, once again, I think there's just so much nostalgia. Like, did we really need a reboot or anything? Like, I mean, I don't know. Anyway, up next, something a little bit more of a positive light, is we have the main villain confirmed for the upcoming Justice League movie. And, you know, everybody, you know, based on what they saw toward, you know, with the Omega symbol and Batman versus Superman, you know, basically was like, oh, it's going to be, you know, Darkseid, you know, and, well, we now know that it's a little person by the name of Steppenwolf.
You mean the band from the 70s?
I don't know about that Steppenwolf, but I mean,
that'd be pretty awesome, yeah.
I don't know. I'm kind of digging it. I mean, people are like, what is this? I don't know. I mean, maybe we got an older clientele. Kids today are like, I think I've heard this song browsing at the supermarket.
They use it in a Kevin Smith movie. Yeah, they use it in Jane Silent Bob Strikes Back. So people have heard it before.
Yeah, so, you know, casting is underway for Steppenwolf's role. So nothing has been
finalized. So if you don't know who that is, like, you know, he's a minion of Darkseid. He's basically the guy who kind of paves the way for his eventual invasion.
Yes. You know, I think what it's his uncle or something like that, right?
I can't remember. He's like, he's related to Dark. I can't remember if he's a minion or he's related, but yeah, I think he's like the son or something. Or yeah, I have not kept up with DC lore.
Yeah. So up next is something I thought was interesting. So, you know, Star Trek, you know, or not Star Trek, but CBS and Paramount Pictures basically came out.
You can't say Star Trek anymore.
Yeah, fuck. Like, if anything gets us, you know, fucking it, copyright infringement or something, it'll be that right there. I'm sorry. What I meant to say was a
Space
Star
Boy
Trek
movie.
Fan production.
Yeah.
Segment thing.
Yeah, because last year there was going to be pretty much a big budget Star Trek fan film, but then Paramount filed some kind of lawsuit to try to stop it. And since then, they've kind of pulled back. But not pulled back. They're like, all right, you know, we agree fan films are cool and all, but here's our list of what we consider a fan film, and you must do these things for us not to sue you for it.
Yeah. So, you know, basically they come out with, I don't know, you know, 10 so-called rules. And in those 10 rules, there's different caveats and covets and everything else. So if you're interested in making a fan film, these will pretty much deter you from it. You know, and yeah. Also, too, if you come out with any ideas that are great and everything, then CBS and Paramount basically say, hey, we can steal your idea and there's nothing you can do about it. Yay! Anyway, moving on. Something a little bit more positive. Resident Evil 7. Fan of the Resident Evil games? I am. So, basically, Capcom has come out and said that, you know, Resident Evil 7 will have no QuickTime events. And that was one of the things that kind of always deterred the action, you know, from some of the later Resident Evil games.
Yeah, because like I said, it started off in that survival horror, and then it kind of turned into more of a action games.
I mean, which, don't get me wrong, the action you know, in Resident Evil 6, it felt genuine. But the quick time events, not so much. Like, all of a sudden, you're into button-mashing mode. Like, no, give me more puzzles. Give me more of the survival horror and stuff like that. Don't make it a, oh, well, let's test your reflexes. Like, that doesn't... That
if you want to show me a cut scene, show me a cut scene. Like, yes. You don't have to, like, you know, yeah, that's my time to get another beer. Like, you don't have to, like, get me involved. Just let it play.
Yeah, absolutely. So... Up next, in a little bit of Ghostbusters news and our, I guess, final tidbit of information for this segment is just weeks before the launch of the new Ghostbusters film, Sony has announced plans for an animated series. And guess what? This one probably won't suck.
Woo-hoo!
Because Melissa McCartney and crew won't be along, you know, as part of this. It's basically going to be Ghostbusters set in the year 2050, and the team will travel to globe hunting ghosts, and then they'll also be getting assist from local units and stuff like that.
Which sounds like, I think there at one point there was, like, back in the day before the new Ghostbusters reboot, that was one of the planned sequels, was that it was, they were going to be like franchises of the original Ghostbusters team in different cities and whatnot. And I think that sounds like a better storyline than what we're getting, where it's, you know, a continuation of the original story, but far enough forward that you don't need the original characters, but you can still refer back to them. Like, oh, we were, I'm Ray's great grandson or some, or granddaughter, whatever you want it to be. Yeah. Or we were trained by the OG Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
You know, and that way it stays in the universe without freaking booting.
Yep. So, Ivan, you know, Reitman, the director of the first two Ghostbusters films, is behind this project, and they're shooting for a 2018 debut.
Sweet.
So, I'm looking forward to that. He was also, the franchise has been on TV before with the Real Ghostbusters and then Extreme Ghostbusters, which were basically, you know, continuations of the original films. So. I'm excited for it. See what it has in store. I don't know. I have higher hopes for the animated version than I do this new live action version that we're getting.
Yeah, because even that Ghostbusters Extreme was cool because it was basically a new team of Ghostbusters, but they were being trained by Egon, so it connected to that, you know, original story.
Any other tidbits, things folks might find interesting?
Have you watched any of the E3 coverage since that just happened?
You know, I've been tied up. I've DVR'd a lot of the E3 stuff. I've seen, you know, on some of the tech sites, you know, some of the console hardware revisions that are coming down the line with, you know, both PS4 and Xbox One getting some hardware beef updates. And then, you know, some of the VR stuff is just absolutely, like, got me, like,
some,
you know...
Some gameplay footage of, apparently there's a, I don't know if it's the same new Resident Evil, but a virtual reality Resident Evil game coming out that looks pretty. I think Sony announced they're going to have like 50 games at launch of their VR platform. And there's some footage of apparently the new Zelda game is supposed to be like just huge open world, bigger than Skyrim, and people are kind of freaking out over that.
No, I mean, I'm super excited for that because... I mean, you really haven't had, you know, I know we've had a couple of versions of Zelda on the Wii and stuff like that, and that did bring some updated graphics and, you know, enhanced gameplay, but, you know, to have a completely open world environment like that is just going to be super immersive and everything.
All right, and with that, check us out on CigarNerdPodcast.com. We're also on the ESO Network at ESOPodcast.com. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Cigar Nerd Pod. If you want some cool merchandise, check out our Zazzle store and Real Men Smoke Cigars. There's links to both those pages on our website. And remember, there can be only one. And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast. We're your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.